When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to Unheard. Overnight, a statement came out from the American Defense Department. And I quote, "Today, the militaries of the United States and the United Kingdom, with support from Australia, Bahrain, Canada, and the Netherlands, conducted strikes against military targets in Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen. This action is intended to disrupt and degrade the Houthis' capabilities to endanger mariners and threaten global trade in one of the world's most critical waterways." Statements like that will give many of us shivers the last few times that we've heard about Western military actions into Arab countries, whether it's Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, even Syria. It hasn't ended as intended. In this emergency episode, we want to talk through what is actually going on, whether it's wise, and what might happen next. And to help us do that, we are joined by Tom McTague, our very own political editor here at Unheard, who has been diving into some of the history of this part of the world for his excellent podcast, These Times, which I heartily recommend. So let's just talk about this part of the world. We've got a map of it here just to help us orient ourselves. It's one of the parts of the world that people know least about, I would say, in the West. It sort of connects the Mediterranean European zone with the Indian Ocean and the routes to China and Asia. Give us a bit of a tour of the geography.
So we have Yemen at the southern end of the Red Sea on the Arabian Peninsula, facing into Africa, where there's currently a whole series of disputes over land and control. And this part of the world has actually been really important, although it's kind of unknown. It's been incredibly important to the West, and particularly for Britain, for a good 150 years, 200 years now. So it started with British wrestling control of Aden, which is a city at the southern end of Yemen. And this was before the Suez Canal, which is up in the north of the Red Sea, connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean through Egypt, before that was even built. So we took control of this part of the world to protect our trade routes into India, principally.
Now, so we weren't going through the Suez Canal at that stage.
We weren't going through
the Suez Canal. There was no Suez Canal.
No, there was no Suez Canal.
So why was this an important trade route?
It was a coaling station. So it was a way of just protecting this whole area, because we were going round the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa from Europe into India. And actually, the Suez Canal was built by the French as an attempt to try and undermine Britain's control of the sea routes to Asia. And so it was thought that they could make a quicker route through in Britain, and they would be able to disrupt that and challenge Britain. In the end, what happened is Britain dominated the new route through the Red Sea and into the Mediterranean. And so it didn't have that effect. But then the Suez Canal became incredibly important to us, and it was our quickest route to India, which was obviously the jewel in the empire.
And this is still the case, right? We've been hearing on the TV recently, in recent days, about how that route from, say, China to Europe is dramatically shorter, dramatically more efficient than trying to go all the way around Africa. So suddenly this part of the world that, frankly, nobody in the West knows a lot about, very few people do, and probably don't care very much about, is suddenly of vital strategic importance, because it affects the prices of what we're buying in the shops.
That's exactly right. I read that it takes 20 days longer to get from Asia to Europe by going round South Africa rather than through the Suez Canal. And that adds something like $1 million to every shipping container coming to Europe. And so that's just going to be passed on. That is just inflation. So that is the principal reason why we are interested in this. This means consumers in the West are going to pay more for their goods at a time when we are desperately trying to get inflation under control.
So let's look at the map again. So we have Yemen, this country south of Saudi Arabia, that, as you say, is across the Red Sea from Africa. On the African side, that's the Horn of Africa you see at the bottom of that map. That's Somalia. There's been basically chaos in that part of the world for some time. There's been a lot of pirates, and that shipping route, as I understand it, has already been vulnerable for a number of years because of Somali pirates. I haven't heard that much about that recently. I suppose there have been methods to keep that under control. But there's Djibouti, the port city right there in the middle, and then Eritrea. Sudan has obviously had its own civil war. So it's a troubled part of the world on the African side as well. On the Gulf side, tell us what's been happening in Yemen.
Yemen has been split between North and South for a long time. And actually, it was united in the 90s. And then it was disrupted very much by the invasion of Iraq. Going back to your original point about how Western interventions have not gone well in this region. And it's at around this time that the Houthis, we are now taking military action against, have started to rise. And really, we can trace the modern history back to 2014, which is the beginning of the civil war in Yemen, which is the Houthis launching a sort of insurrection against the official government. Based in the south and being remarkably successful and getting all the way to Aden at some point.
The name Houthi is actually after their original leader.
That's right,
There was a guy called al-Houthi who was the kind of, I guess, rebel leader of that particular group. They're Zaidi Shias, aren't they? There's a particular branch of Shia Islam that they follow. And I think already in the 80s, 90s, he was beginning to be active.
That's right. And I think it's passed on to his brother now, who's taking the lead.
And the fact that they're Shia in most people's understanding means they're more likely to be aligned with Iran.
That's right. And they are aligned to Iran. Although I think from all accounts, that is slightly overplayed in that they are not the creation of Iran, but they have emerged and they have been supported by Iran. And the original action by the West was to try and block Iranian attempts to supply the Houthis through the Gulf of Aden there. So this has been going since 2014, and Saudi Arabia launched a war against the Houthis to try and stop this in 2015.
Can I just go back a little bit further? Yeah. First of all, to 2011, the Arab Spring.
Right, yeah.
Is that not when the first rebellion happened? Because that's when the former government fell.
Yes.
Another salutary reminder that moments that in the West everyone celebrates as the inexorable march of progress don't always end so well. So the original government falls in 2011, 2014, this insurrection takes place. Basically, they've controlled parts or substantial parts of Yemen ever since?
Absolutely. They now control 70% of the Yemeni population. So this is not... They're not rebels anymore. They are in control of most of Yemen, most of the population of Yemen. And there is now a sort of a ceasefire, which has almost legitimized them. And so this has been going on since 2014, the civil war. And this, we didn't accept this. This was something that we tried to stop. When I say we, I mean the West and the Saudi-led coalition that launched a war against them. It was Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, Bahrain, and then supported by the UK and US. So this is an incredibly wealthy coalition with the most sort of high-tech military equipment, and yet they failed to defeat the Houthis. Now, I think that is a warning to us today. And because there is a kind of asymmetry to this war in that the Houthis can launch these attacks using very cheap drones and other military equipment, and we respond with incredibly expensive missiles that cost millions of dollars or millions of pounds. And so our war is much more expensive than their war. And that, I think, is part of the problem here.
So that Saudi attack or the intervention into the Yemeni civil war that ultimately failed and they withdrew and there's now, as you say, this ceasefire, was itself controversial.
Yes.
It's another reminder of these sort of shifting alliances and where the kind of received opinion tends to swap sides periodically because it was considered immoral.
Yes.
Because the Saudis were using weapons from the UK, from the US. They were causing a lot of civilian casualties inside Yemen. It was politically very controversial. And ultimately, we, as the West, US-led sort of bloc, didn't support Saudi to the end. Is that right?
So
we supported them in the beginning, and then the media pressure, the narrative became so uncomfortable that America pretty much abandoned them.
That's right. Yeah, under Obama and then later under Biden. I mean, Trump though was a different order, and I think this is again an interesting challenge to those of us who try to think about these issues. We would think about Obama and Biden as often painted as the kind of wiser heads in the Middle East. But on this story, you know, Biden took the Houthis off the terror list, and now he's going to war against them. And Trump was obviously much more supportive of the Saudi Arabian attempts to push back against the Houthis. So it's a very complicated history, and not one that plays easily to conventional wisdom.
It also challenges those of us, I think, maybe even all of us, who get anxious when we see a new military action because of the repeated failures of the past. Less isn't always less in that sense, that it looks like the disruption that came from the Arab Spring in 2011, then the failure to deal with the Houthi problem has led us to where we are now. Mm-hmm. So can you make the case that we should have been stronger earlier and then we wouldn't be in this position?
Absolutely. But we're constantly pinging around from trying to correct the mistakes of the last crisis. You know, I think the failed war in Afghanistan and the failed war in Iraq clearly played a part in how we think about the wars that came afterwards, the Syrian civil war, and then obviously this today. And this sense that what is the moral position that we need to take is clearly dominant during the Obama presidency and the Biden presidency, and the political pressure not to get involved because the Saudis were a difficult partner. But now we're doing the same job the Saudis tried to do.
There's a crucial difference, isn't there, which I think you highlighted in a piece you wrote on Unheard today, between a kind of interventionist neocon idea of a foreign adventure, which you could say both Iraq and Afghanistan became, which was imbued with this sense of fixing things, helping countries move towards democracy. There were all sorts of things that in retrospect seem incredibly naive and misplaced. Mm-hmm. There isn't much of that going on in this particular conflict, is there? So it is different from previous interventions, and it seems more hard-nosed and more aligned to just pretty obvious self-interest.
Absolutely. It's quite an interesting war in that it feels very old-fashioned in this respect. It feels like the kind of war that we might have launched in the 19th century, where we are just protecting our commercial interests. And it's very clear. But then that is a defensible position to take. This is a relatively small group who are armed with cheap weapons, who are very poor, and they are managing to have an outsized influence on some of the wealthiest countries in the world, in Europe, in the United States, and of course in China, and by disrupting the trade that is going through this crucial part of the world. So that is something that is affecting all Western consumers. And so if that's not a reason to get involved to protect that, then what is? What are we using our militaries for? I mean, that is the argument essentially that is being made internally in number 10 here in Britain, but it's the same argument that will be made in the United States.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It goes to this big question of who runs these parts of the world, doesn't it? Because we've been used in the long kind of Pax Americana, as they call it, to the idea that America is the world's policeman. Awkward parts of the world that need to be kept in check will be basically dealt with by America. That is now looking shakier as America is clearly stretched and has multiple fronts, and there are other powers such as China, such as Russia, such as Iran, that are very keen to destabilize that. It's quite interesting that the list of nations taking part in this could have been 20 years ago, really. I mean, I read it out in the introduction there. It's a few Western countries, a couple of Gulf, very sympathetic nations, and then America and the UK. It doesn't seem that different from the original Iraq coalition of the willing.
Absolutely. And you have to wonder at what point in the US and the UK in particular, we will say, well, why are we paying a disproportionate cost to keep these lanes open? Britain is certainly not the dominant commercial trade exporter or in Europe. That is clearly Germany. And the United States is actually not so invested in this particular trade route as Europe and China. So China is the great exporter of the world that uses this lane to export its goods into Europe, which is one of the principal ways in which it is becoming one of the two superpowers in the world. Europe is dependent on this sea route to get its energy supplies in from the Middle East, both in terms of gas and in oil, particularly after the war in Russia.
So where's China?
So where's China?
Why is China not on the list? I guess it would be quite unusual at this stage in our diplomatic relations to do a joint military adventure with China. But why is China not sorting this out? They're the ones who are benefiting from it.
Exactly. Surely that's what Donald Trump will say and those around him. They will say, once again, we're the schmucks. We're paying to keep open a sea lane that ultimately benefits China and Europe. So we're protecting Europe and we're paying the cost all the time to enable others to get wealthy. That is presumably what those around Donald Trump will say. And of course, there is a kernel of truth to that. But the challenge for those in the United States who take that view is, do you really want to allow China to start policing the world's shipping lanes? That is the source, the fundamental source of your power. And so if we go back to the map, and that country, Djibouti, that sits opposite Yemen.
That's just next to the Bab al-Mandeb Strait there, that small port nation.
Yeah, and in that small country, there are at least four powers who have military bases, which just shows you how important...
Which countries?
So they are the French, the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Americans.
Wow.
So they're all there. Actually, Britain, we have a base in Oman and a base in Bahrain. So we actually, ironically, have moved back west of Suez, and this happened under the coalition.
So that's probably, I guess, why the UK is playing such a prominent role in this particular strike, because it has assets that are useful on that side of the Gulf.
We have assets, and we've also built these two aircraft carriers. So all of these things are actually the decisions that were taken decades ago or started decades ago are now incredibly important, because our other base is effectively Cyprus, which is at the very north of this map. And that is effectively our giant aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean, which allows us to intervene in Iraq.
But it's such a fascinating moment in this kind of evolving live history. Every week we're documenting this so-called move to multipolarity,
yep,
the shift in the global world order. And yet, when the shit hits the fan,
yep,
it's the UK and the US leading a coalition of the willing,
yep,
as they talked about in 2003, sorting out a problem that affects almost the whole world.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it's a fascinating challenge for Britain as well, post-Brexit Britain, is why do we feel the need to be at the front of this, as what some people call like the tip of the spear on these interventions. That is the role that we're playing in Ukraine. We are the most forward-leaning of all the European countries, and that is the role that we're playing here. Now, when you put this to people inside Number 10, they'll say, well, it's power. It's influence. You know, that is the point of foreign policy. This is why we are, this is why we remain influential. But we're also quite poor at the moment. And there are other countries in Europe that are quite rich and who are benefiting from this. And they manage to remain rich without getting involved.
There's also a big political cost. Mm. Because if we put the map back up, there's a country at the top of this map called Israel, and right next to it, Gaza and the West Bank, that obviously are absolutely in the center of this, because the reason, as I understand it, that these Houthi rebels are suddenly more popular, yeah, with local groups than they were, mm-hmm, is because of the Israel-Gaza war.
Yeah.
That their rationale, at least, for suddenly attacking all of these ships, mm, was that they were singling out Israel-bound or Israel-connected, mm-hmm, container ships for attack.
Yeah.
And it was their movement in solidarity with the Palestinians, which suddenly flips them from being just a terrorist group or a gang of thugs into being some kind of resistance fighters, freedom fighters, that are much harder for local Arab neighbors to squash.
Absolutely. And they'll also, by playing that role, get support in the West from those who see this primarily as a sort of, you know, through imperial lens. So this is a, you know...
Well, Jeremy Corbyn is already talking out, speaking very vociferously against these strikes into Yemen.
Absolutely, as are Irish MEPs and others, and they'll be supporting the US, I'm sure, from those on the left who are critical of Israel's response. Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting moment because the Houthis are not attacking Chinese or Russian ships that are going through this strait. They are attacking only those connected to Israel or those countries that support Israel, which are, of course, the West. So that might be the Chinese response for why they're not getting involved, where it doesn't affect us. We're managing to get through this part of the world easily enough.
And so actually it's almost part of this new sort of Western versus anti-Western global struggle.
Absolutely.
This is just the latest front.
Absolutely. I think it's very difficult to understand all of this properly unless you understand the struggle between the United States and China for global supremacy. And you're seeing that in so many different theaters now. You're obviously seeing it in Ukraine and with the Russian invasion. You're seeing it in Israel, and we may start to see it in the South China Sea. Now, the ultimate conundrum for the Americans is, where do you place your firepower? And it wanted to shift it from the Middle East towards China, to face China, to protect Taiwan, which some of those who are influential around Trump see as ultimately the key, the sort of the keystone to American dominance in Asia. If you lose Taiwan, you then end up losing the Philippines. Japan can't be protected, and you have to withdraw back towards Hawaii. So you have to shift all of your focus towards there. Well, they can't. They can't at the moment because of what you pointed out before. They are ultimately responsible for the defense of Ukraine. Ukraine would have fallen without American support. And they are ultimately responsible for the defense of Israel. And we saw that after the October 7th attacks, where the United States shifted, I think it was two aircraft carriers, I think, to the Mediterranean as a warning to Iran and Hezbollah not to invade. So the question is, can they do all of this at the same time and protect the shipping routes through the Red Sea?
Well, I guess we will find out the answer in the coming weeks. But let's be a bit skeptical for a moment, because I'm sure that we will have viewers who are pretty skeptical about this adventure as they were about previous ones and may think that it is morally indefensible to start bombing faraway countries. Let's go through those arguments and take them seriously. The first question is the legality of this. Already Russia, unsurprisingly, has come out and said this is an illegal strike against international law. It's not a UN peacekeeping force. It's just a random group of countries led by the US and the UK. It's therefore illegal. As I understand it, the legal basis for this was the UN resolution on the 9th of January, a few days ago, which asserted the right of UN member states to, quote, defend their vessels from attack, including those that undermine navigational rights and freedoms. And that was passed, and I think Russia abstained rather than vetoed, which is quite significant. So it would even though they've subsequently claimed it was illegal, there's the sense that Russia is sort of tacitly allowing this to happen.
They will presumably argue, as they did in Libya, that the West is abusing these the route through the UN, and Russia has agreed something, and the West has then gone further than what is allowed, and that was clearly true in Libya. I'm not an expert on the legal situation, but I think clearly that is going to be politically is going to be an argument that will certainly take hold. I mean, you're already seeing it in the UK, where this action has taken place without any parliamentary approval. So that will be politically is going to be very difficult to sustain this without some form of political support being granted for it.
It's amazing how similar it is in that sense to previous military strikes. The UN resolution that doesn't actually explicitly allow it, but is used as legal cover. The group of nations who kind of club together, led by the US and the UK, with a few smaller nations that are probably not contributing that much, but are used to make it look like a larger coalition. The fights over whether Parliament should be involved, the Liberal Democrats here in the UK are already complaining that there hasn't been a parliamentary vote, as there should be if we go to war. And it shows the fragility and maybe the inadequacy of those big supranational institutions, like most importantly the UN. It's not really doing anything in this, is it? It almost might as well not be there.
Well, exactly. I mean, you just wonder whether we should just talk honestly and say that the reason... I mean, I think there is a line in this, actually, when the US talk about this, that it's about delays to shipping going through here, which are delays to people getting their goods. So it's almost like, you know, your Amazon delivery not arriving on time is a justification for military strikes, which sounds kind of ludicrous, but I mean, it is effectively, that is, we are waging a kind of, it's not a war, but a small-scale intervention against somebody because they are affecting our commercial interests. This is very different, and it's hard to see how something like that, how the UN can fit into that very basic kind of understanding of the world.
And groups like this, we don't have someone from the Houthis to interview, because that's not going to happen. I mean, these are very far away, very rough, frankly, quite scary groups of people. You know, we know very little about them. That's the reality, isn't it? It's a very disorderly situation. We know that the group motto...
Yes, I was going to say. Of what we know is not good.
Of the Houthis... The official name is Ansar Allah, Supporters of God Movement, and their motto is "Death to America, Death to Israel, Curse the Jews, God is Great."
Yes.
So that sort of sums it up.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we'll be added to that list. Death
well,
to
that's the danger.
Well, I mean, it's presumably that is where we place ourselves at risk. So I think one of the challenges that some of our viewers will think is why us? not just a moral question, then there is the, why are we in this position? Why are we exposing ourselves to this in particular? And then I guess there are questions of efficacy as well. Whereas if the Saudi Arabians spending, I think it was $6 billion a month on the war in Yemen, were unable to win. And let's, you know, let's be frank about it. Mohammed bin Salman is not going to have pursued that war less vigorously than we are. You know, I think he will be less concerned.
So the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who had an enormous army behind him with the best equipment money can buy, he still didn't manage.
He didn't win. And I think he would be less concerned about civilian casualties than we will be. And he didn't manage to win. So are we willing to pay $6 billion a month to sustain this war? And for how long? And is there any sense that we can actually win this? And is this asymmetry that I talked about going to be a real problem for us? Because again, look at the aims here of what we're trying to achieve. They're trying to sow chaos, to win international support for themselves, to undermine Israel's position, and to disrupt the West in the process. Obviously, Iran sits behind this and benefits from all of that as well. And what are we trying to achieve? We're trying to ensure order. Now, that is a very expensive thing to try and do. And ensuring order doesn't come through, you know, development spending and state building and all the rest. It's ultimately through the barrel of a gun. And it's the American gun that we've been reliant upon for so long. But now, can they do all of that? I think that's the real fundamental question.
And some people might say it's not just order that we are trying to insist on. It's a particular world order.
Absolutely,
with
yeah.
the US at the head. And so Russia and China and Iran are not incentivized to keep that world order in place. They want to disrupt it. They want moves towards chaos. And there are increasing numbers of countries who are on that side of things, who say, yeah, we'll take a period of chaos to dethrone the US and to shuffle things about. Mm. So I guess in hope of a new settlement that will favor them better.
Absolutely. But I mean, China is the interesting question then in this particular crisis, because it benefits enormously from freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas. This is its principal trade route into the West. Does it really want a period of disorder in this part of the world? I don't think so.
There was a quote speaking of this skepticism about whether it will actually work from someone called Adam Clements, a former US Army attaché to Yemen. This was in the news today. He said he is, quote, fairly pessimistic the strikes will have the intended effect of deterring further attacks. The Houthis have accumulated years of experience in hiding their supplies and mitigating risks. And in that sense, it reminds a little bit of the Israeli campaign in Gaza. Mm-hmm. It's another grand objective. We're going to destroy Hamas, or we're going to destroy the Houthi leadership. We are going to degrade their ability to attack us. And yet, as you say, this is a movement supported by lots of people, mm-hmm. which is only amplified and fueled by attacks from America and the UK mm-hmm. and Israel in that case. And their munitions are homemade explosives, or they're cheap to produce drones that many different countries can provide them with. You got to be a bit pessimistic if you're reasonable that this is going to be any easier to achieve than what Israel's trying to do in Gaza.
Or what we tried to do in Afghanistan, where you had a similar situation. You had enormous military capabilities, enormous numbers of troops, and you had an army opposing you that were using very cheap weapons, but had enough support in the country to eventually be able to win if they lasted longer than you. And clearly, the Houthis probably think that they will outlast the West in their control of that part of the world. I mean, it does remind me, there, going back all the way to 1967, just before Britain pulled all of its forces out from, announced all of its forces would be leaving east of Suez, we wouldn't return until under David Cameron, years later, that we had this base in Aden, and we had to leave after 4 years of sustained guerrilla warfare against us. We didn't want to leave. It was the policy of the Wilson government and all the British establishment to protect that base, because it was a very important part, as we've discussed, of our commercial interests. But we were ran out after 4 years of guerrilla campaigning from the local population, and we left with a tail between our legs and came home. So we've been here before.
It's not the first time we've seen this.
It's not the first time we've seen it.
And
this
challenge.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't bet against this going wrong.
Final thought. You mentioned David Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
The cynic in me is a little bit anxious about the coincidence of timing where David Cameron, who is notoriously enthusiastic about military strikes in Arab countries with virtuous ends that ultimately go wrong,
mm-hmm.
has been out of government for a number of years, suddenly comes back as foreign secretary, and then bingo, here we are announcing military strikes again. Do you think that's just a coincidence?
It's not just a coincidence in that he's clearly played a very prominent role since he's come back as foreign secretary, allowing Sunak to concentrate more on domestic policy. My understanding is that still foreign policy is ultimately controlled from number 10. But he is supremely confident in his own judgment, I think we could say. And he may have been shaped by his experiences, or he almost certainly was. He wants to repair his reputation that was damaged principally, I think, now in Libya, which was a total disaster, where it was a British and French-led operation that ultimately required American support, hand-holding. And Obama felt very bruised about this. They felt misled by Cameron and Sarkozy. And actually, if you look at the map again, that intervention in Libya did more than anything to disrupt North African stability. And then the second one, of course, is Syria in 2013 and the vote to join the airstrikes to enforce President Obama's red line that never got enforced. Now, the vote in the House of Commons that went against the strikes, that was the cause of the domino. That was the start of the domino effect that led to Obama himself offering Congress a vote. So I don't think it's a coincidence that we have not put this to a vote in the House of Commons. I think that is something that the government, the sort of the power of the government, they want to wrestle back from Parliament because they, in their estimation, it was a disaster to give that to MPs.
And at the very least, you can see in this a wrestling between different views of how the world should be run.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a more old-fashioned traditional view,
mm-hmm.
which is that the US and the UK should be running things. And if there are sort of disobedient nations doing things, they need to be policed. And Cameron is ultimately still from that generation. So the fact that he has returned as foreign secretary is embodiment of that struggle, isn't it?
Absolutely. But it's very difficult for the West this, because you effectively have a terrorist campaign against commercial shipping. What do you do about that? Do you just allow it to happen? And the Chinese it's an easier conundrum for them because their ships aren't being attacked. So it's very difficult. I think even a new generation prime minister would struggle with this. But there are clearly other options. And I think the great risk is that we don't have the attention span, just like in Libya and just like in Syria, to actually see this through. And ultimately, do we have the money to pay for such a sustained war in this part of the world? Or are we going to have to share the burden? And that might mean bringing much bigger coalition, including those from outside the West. And that would be a real indication of the declining power of the West and the rise of others.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
That was Tom McTague, Unheard's political editor, talking through with me the world's newest war, or perhaps we should say the newest front in the longer war that has officially started in Yemen this morning. Thanks for tuning in. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.